This image emerged just from a flippant comment I made when we were discussing it one day. I said, I can't make sense of this. It's just, the whole thing's just a patchwork. And I realized it was. So then I drew the patchwork, and that's what the image is.
Welcome to the AccuTrack podcast. I'm Spod.
And I'm Nick. We're both acupuncture practitioners and researchers.
And he's the clever one.
And Spod's the data guy.
So welcome to the AccuTrack podcast. And in this episode, we welcome Richard Clark. Richard Clark has spent over 40 years practicing, teaching and researching acupuncture. He trained in traditional and Western acupuncture, medicine and humanistic therapy. He developed a unique, intricate style of practice, and he taught at several schools of acupuncture to professional acupuncturists, doctors, podiatrists, physiotherapists, and osteopaths, and was course leader of the master's program in complementary therapy studies at the University of Westminster. Commissioned by the NHS, he developed and ran the first podiatric acupuncture course, which led him to research the evidence base, co-publish critical and systematic reviews, and eventually to write a book. So welcome, Richard.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Richard, great to have you on. And really, your speciality and your research focus in your career has been plantar heel pain. I want to ask you how you got interested in this topic of plantar heel pain. But just first, for all our listeners, I think it'd be great to just have an understanding. What is plantar heel pain? How do we define it? What are its main symptoms?
If only it were that simple. Plantar heel pain is heel in the plantar, is pain in the plantar surface of the heel, of course. But the term is commonly conflated with the term plantar fasciitis, which was the original label for this condition. People are still debating which is the best term. It's referring, of course, to pain felt under the heel, usually worse for weight bearing. And usually worse when you've been off your feet for a while. So first thing in the morning, or if you've been resting for a while. And it's also associated with tenderness, which is usually felt at the medial side, the anterior end of the calcaneum. This is a subject I got into only at the latter end of my career. My own practice for several decades was very mixed indeed, and integrated with orthodox medicine and psychotherapy and lots of other integrative practices. But I had got involved with the British Medical Association in the 90s and ended up teaching for them and ended up as the chair of their education committee. And then one day in came a request from a group of podiatrists to teach them acupuncture. At that time, the BMAS was only teaching doctors and had a fairly clear boundary about that. This was before osteopaths and chiropractors got statutory recognition, of course. So they refused. The BMAS said they wouldn't take this on. But I knew that there were other medical acupuncturists who were teaching podiatrists, and I knew that they were teaching a fairly narrow form of the art. So I decided I'd take it on. I knew there are lots of people who are critical of short course trainings of medical professionals. But I thought there are a number of reasons why I thought it was a good idea. I thought better that they get taught by somebody who has some awareness of and sympathy towards what we might call proper acupuncture. And these people will be able to practice in a limited way, but that will save them from using other techniques, which are perhaps more invasive or more likely to have adverse effects. such as steroid injections or the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So I could say more, but that's the basis of how I got into it, really.
Yeah, great. And you mentioned a couple of treatments there, as well as physiotherapy, presumably. Are there any other conventional, quote unquote, treatments for plantar heel pain, plantar fasciitis? What are the sort of other options that people have when they've got this condition? And I'm also interested in the prevalence. How common is it for people to have plantar fasciitis, plantar heel pain? What are the sort of activities that might be likely to bring this on? You know, long distance runners, for example.
Yes, it certainly is common. And the one statistic I just read this morning is that 1 in 10 of us can expect to experience it during our lifetime. And there's a wealth of different approaches that are used, which perhaps is a testament to how unreliable they are. The first thing that people will do is perhaps rest or be told to rest. They may be offered some insoles to put into their shoes, either off-the-shelf ones, relatively cheap, or custom-made ones, pretty expensive. They may be taught some stretching exercises to stretch the plantar fascia itself and muscles in the feet, or to press to stretch the gastroceleus muscles. If they see a doctor, they're likely to be offered non-steroidal drugs. If they see a doctor or a physio with an interest in feet, they will possibly be given an injection, a steroid injection into the tender point, into the plantar fascia itself. There are more invasive approaches. Surgery, of course, is a common one in those who don't recover within a year or so. And I've even heard of radiotherapy being used.
Oh, interesting.
More recently, not very frequently, but there are the odd papers in the literature. And then, where was I? There is shockwave therapy, a form of ultrasound treatment, which has a reasonable track record. And more recently, I've been noticing more and more papers on the subject of PRP, platelet-rich plasma injections, where the patient's own blood is extracted. Platelet-rich plasma is derived from it by centrifuging and then injected back into the tissues with a view to stimulating a healing response. So there's a quick summary of the range of interventions that might be used.
That's a good summary, Richard. And some of these slightly newer therapies, one's assuming that there's not going to have been a ton of research done on some of these new approaches. What's the evidence base like generally for some of these conventional therapies in terms of trials, study numbers, that kind of thing? And then really I want to kind of bring in how you got interested and what you found when you started to engage in the research of acupuncture, specifically the plantar heel pain.
Well, that's what led me into it. I was teaching these podiatrists who were going off and trying it out. And a number of people were coming back saying, hey, it's fantastic. I have patients with plantar fasciitis and one treatment and they're better. So they were all convinced by the beginner's luck that we all seem to experience. Of course, most patients don't get better after one treatment simply by needling the Ashi point.
The Ashi point, for those who might not be aware of the term, is that going to be the local tender point in the foot that, you know, will be causing the most pain. So one acupuncture approach for treating plantar heel pain is just go straight for the bullseye.
And and Richard, I guess you're talking about the on the plantar surface of the heel, where the skin is very thick and very full of pain receptors.
Yes and no. That is what some people would do. The technique that I taught my students to use is a medial approach, inserting on the medial side of the heel.
But okay, you're coming in and through the plantar fascia. You're just not going in from the bottom. You're going in from the side.
Yes. If you you can palpate for a tender point on the plantar surface itself, but more commonly and more easily, you can do so on the medial surface. And just you will usually find a tender point at the corner of the bone there. And the tissues are less thick, so it's easier to feel. And, of course, much easier to insert a needle. There's actually a lot more to say about this and different techniques, so maybe we'll come back to it. Rather than digress too far from the thing about the evidence base.
Okay, so you hear that, everyone. We're going to cover the research first and then stay tuned as we will get more into the technical aspects of actually how we might go about treating plantar heel pain after the evidence summary.
Okay. The point was that these podiatrists that I was teaching worked in the NHS, and they were therefore required to produce an evidence base for what they were doing. And I realized that I wasn't very familiar with an evidence base, and they certainly weren't. So I had a look, and there isn't one, or there wasn't one. So I set about compiling all the evidence together with a partner. We did a systematic review, and we found half a dozen comparative studies or control trials that were extraordinarily mixed. In whichever aspect of a study you look at, they were all different.
The researcher's nightmare.
Exactly. It makes it really difficult for somebody who wants to do reductionist research and produce systematic reviews and meta-analyses and so on and so on. We did find that there were two papers that had a clearly positive, supportive result saying that, yes, acupuncture did good in this case. But they were very different. One of them was looking at athletes with relatively acute heel pain, and they used a traditional acupuncture approach. It wasn't entirely clear from the paper, but they used a whole range of different points, obviously different ones in different patients, but they were selected from a pre-decided set of points. The other paper was very different. They did a rigorous, good quality, randomized control trial comparing the effects of needling pericardium 6 with needling large intestine 4. And they did find that the former was somewhat better than the latter.
Interesting. So there was a difference between those two points.
Indeed, which sort of surprising given that LI4 is used for pain relief anyway in all sorts of conditions. It was a rather strange choice, I thought, of a control point. Nevertheless, they found a difference.
And in this trial, they didn't needle the foot at all.
Indeed. Which was one of the interesting things that emerged from the further research that we did, with the frustration of the heterogeneity of our findings in the systematic review, we decided to do a qualitative study, bringing in all of the papers, all of the sources that we could find, to get a deeper and broader picture of what's actually going on. Mm. And we did it in the form of a critical interpretive synthesis, which is a particular way of approaching qualitative analysis. The gist of it is we searched all the databases we could. We followed all the leads from every paper that we found. We searched on the internet. We asked everybody we knew. And we looked at all the books we'd got on our shelves. And we compiled a big list of all papers that had anything to say about how to deal with this problem using acupuncture. And there were about two dozen sources giving information about original clinical work. So some were case studies, some were case series, some were controlled trials, and so on. But then there were also theoretical works, textbooks, giving information, some specifically, a couple specifically about this problem, and others reference books about points that mentioned heel pain in passing as one of the things this point might be used for, that kind of thing. So that was the subject of our second paper, the qualitative one. And that was surprising. Our findings were surprising. We knew that there was heterogeneity, and what we were trying to do, I guess, was to find simple patterns. I was still, I guess, laboring under the misapprehension that there's a simple answer to this question. how do you treat heel pain with acupuncture? Everybody thinks there's going to be a simple answer. I remember I spoke to a colleague, a well-known holistic practitioner, and he said, surely that's simple, is just a trigger point in the soleus, isn't it? And I speak to other traditionalists who say, oh yes, Master Tung's got points for that on the hand. And that's And then they stopped thinking. Well, we didn't stop thinking. We looked and looked, and we came up with all sorts of different things. One of the charts that we came across, one of the charts you'll find in the publication is the patchwork image. I'm holding it up so that you can see it on your screens now. And yes, we can set a link for this to people, find it online somewhere.
That's right. So we've got, there'll be a link in the show notes and the episode description for everyone. Please go to check it out. Richard's got some great graphs and diagrams from his research, and some slides and some images that you can go and see. They're well worth having up while you follow along listening to the episode.
Great. So this image emerged just from a flippant comment I made when we were discussing it one day. I said, I can't make sense of this. It's just, the whole thing's just a patchwork. And I realized it was. So then I drew the patchwork, and that's what the image is. And it's all of the different factors that seem to impinge on the research process to influence the outcome. And it's not just influencing the outcome in patients, you know, treatment so-and-so results in outcome so-and-so. But it's the philosophy of the researcher and how that influences the very questions that you ask, and how those questions that you entertain will influence the results that you get.
So Richard, I've got this in front of me now. Okay. So maybe you could talk through the layout and what it all means.
Okay, but I don't want to get too lost in the detail here, as you'll see why. So we've got dates at each end, which is the earliest paper we studied and the most recent paper we studied at the point in time that I drafted this. Around the edge are the different countries that all the papers had come from, showing that it was a truly international collection. But then within, the patches within, I don't know if you can read the text, you can see that they apply to all sorts of different aspects of the research process. I'll need to look at it to remind myself. So we've got study type. Is it a case study or an RCT or a comparative study? We've got the patients. Are they old or young? Are they athletes or not athletes, and so on? What are their values? Do they just want to get better? Do they just want to get rid of the pain so they can get back to work? Or do they want to use this pain to learn something from and to transcend it by becoming a different person? And so on and so on.
So I'm guessing, Richard, that although this was helpful, it was helpful in being unhelpful because it hasn't given you one one specific thing to look at, has it? It's given you your patchwork.
Exactly. And that led us in a couple of different directions. The first one was a feminist analysis because I'd come across a paper which talked about quilting as a metaphor for feminist science. And that made me consider the values of the activity that we were doing. And this, it wasn't new. I had seen analyses in the past of the values of traditional acupuncture in research as compared to the values of orthodox reductionist medical research. And the feminist analysis married quite nicely with the traditional acupuncture values. So that wasn't a surprise, but it was useful. And that's something that we wrote up to some extent in our second paper. And I expanded on it in the textbook that I wrote. The other idea that came out of this is a bit more left field, I guess. I got to thinking of the patchwork as a surface. A quilt is a flexible, two-dimensional surface. And it reminded me of images that I'd seen of a sort of Einsteinian model of space-time, where you've got a plane, and then when there's a large, massive object like a planet, it makes a dent in the plane. Are you familiar with that image?
Yes.
Oh, I'm very familiar, yes.
And I thought, here we've got a plane surface, this quilt, this patchwork of factors involved in research. What happens if you make a dent in it? So let's say the first thing you do in entertaining the idea of this research is to say, well, what we need is a randomized controlled trial, of course, because that's what evidence-based medicine is based on. So you then go to the study type and you start with a randomized controlled trial, and it makes a big dent in this surface so that everything else that you put on the surface tends to roll towards it. So the kind of patient that you recruit into your trial is going to be one that conforms to a certain set of criteria. And any patients that don't conform will be excluded. Conversely, if the first thing you do is say, oh, I've got a patient here who's got a complaint, and that complaint happens to be heel pain, and then everything will tend to roll down towards this patient, and the patient's values will become a bigger part of the equation, and the patient's context and circumstances and so on. And so the kind of research, perhaps with a small R and inverted commas, that you do with that patient will be very different from what you would do if your starting point was an RCT.
Mm.
Making sense?
Yeah, that's really well explained, Richard. I think you've articulated really well what I think have been some scattered pieces of puzzle in my brain for years.
So that's what came out of the patchwork.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, so I quite like the patchwork analogy there, and it's it does definitely highlight how difficult your situation is in trying to really understand where to go with this plantar heel pain and research. So let me just propose an imaginary huge bag of cash. So if we had offered you a large imaginary bag of cash that would allow you to do any research you wanted to do, what would you do with that bag of cash? What would the research be? Would it be, you know, multiple different studies? Would it be a big study? Where would you go with it, Richard?
It's hard to pin down because there are some things that you could do that are relatively simple and might give relatively straightforward and usable answers. My concern about that is that such an approach is like wearing blinkers. And my concern would be that we'd miss things. So, for example, one question in my mind is, would it make a difference to these people whose tendency is to just needle a local Ashi point in one place, more or less vigorously? Would it make a difference if instead of doing that, they used a surround the dragon technique and they needled at a number of points a few centimeters around? The physiology or my physiological understanding would lead me to suggest that actually that would be a much better thing to do for a number of reasons. It would be less painful, I imagine, or less daunting for the patient not to have the painful point needled. It should invoke the surround effect, the mechanisms of release of trophic substances into the local tissues that should stimulate local healing. And it should do that better than just a single point, while at the same time, it would be recruiting the same segmental pain pathways in the spinal cord. But it's still focusing on the local problem. It's assuming that the problem is local. Now, in some patients, in my experience, they don't have a local problem. They have trigger points that are giving referred pain. There may be people who had a local plantar problem in the past, and that, by some sort of reflex action, set up trigger points. It initiated trigger points. Now, the local problem has healed for whatever reason, rest, use of orthoses, etc. But the trigger points have persisted, and it's by treating the trigger points that we'll get rid of the pain. Now, you would miss that completely if what you were doing was doing all your research on the Ashi point. Another local approach might be to use the Ashi point and then ask the question, what distant points should we be using as well? Should we be using the DO points, as I call them, the diagonally opposite points, which it found somewhere on the other hand, on the opposite hand? And that would be an interesting line of inquiry as well. But that raises further questions. How do you decide which point on the hand to use? I elaborated on this in the other writings that people use all sorts of different rationales to decide which point to use on the hand. Perhaps the commonest one is to find a tender point. But should we simply accept the assumption that the point which is tender is the one to use? I know lots of people do, but part of my early training suggested to me that we should be treating the points that are less tender than usual, not the ones that are more tender than usual. So again, by focusing in on one bit of research, one topic for research, we might overlook others.
We'd just like to say a quick word about our sponsor. The AccuTrack podcast is delighted to be sponsored by Raise Spirit CBD. There has been an increasing amount of research lately supporting the many benefits of CBD oil. Over the years, I've found more and more of my own patients asking if CBD oil can help them. And as a result, I've personally been recommending Raise Spirit CBD products to my patients to help them with a range of issues from pain to sleep problems, etc. I've known the founder of Raise Spirit, also called Nick, for many years now. He is a former professional athlete, Tai Chi practitioner, and a big fan of acupuncture and Chinese medicine. Nick started Raised Spirit back in 2017, which became the UK's first certified organic CBD oil company. There's a lot of passion and integrity behind the Raised Spirit brand. They only ever use 100% organic natural ingredients. They've got a great range of products. I really wouldn't go anywhere else for my CBD oil. AccuTrack listeners, that's you. You can get a 10% discount of all your first time orders. Just go to www.raisedspiritproducts.com and use the code ACCU10. Links to the website and the discount code are included in the episode description.
So, Richard, from a physiological point of view, with this big bag of cash, would there be a benefit in your view in maybe understanding more about what's actually going on, what damage has occurred, what kind of dysfunction is present in the tissues? Would you say that would be a good way to spend some of our big bag of cash?
Yes, indeed. One of the broader approaches, which I've recommended in my book, is to go back to the phenomenology of this, because most of the researchers, most of the clinicians who work with this, home in on the presenting complaint, and the heel pain itself becomes the focus of everybody's attention. But it doesn't exist in isolation. It exists in the context of the patient, and it exists in the context that the patient themselves exists within, and so on and so on. I suspect that there are different clusters of features that prevail. So I imagine that there are a different cluster of characteristics that apply when you have an acute problem. So if you have one population of patients with acute heel pain, by which I mean, say, less than a month of prior duration, they will have one set of characteristics, whereas those patients who've had it for 6 months or 3 years will manifest a different set of characteristics. A younger population may well manifest differently from an older population. Now, this is perhaps obvious, but what's not obvious to all the medical acupuncture researchers is that there are different syndromes that might be recognized by traditional acupuncturists that could be underlying this. And they, again, will manifest a different set of characteristics. So one of the things that that I came across is the assumption that plantar heel pain, or calcaneurdynia, as it's usually translated from the Chinese papers, is a problem of the bone. And because it was perceived that way, it was assumed that it was related to the kidney qi. Whereas modern science, ultrasound scans, MRI, tissue samples, and so on, tells us that it's not a problem of the bone at all. It's a problem of the soft tissues. And specifically, if it is plantar fasciitis, it's a problem of the fascia. But it might also be a problem of myofascial trigger points. But we're still talking muscles and tendons rather than bone. So maybe we should be looking at liver qi instead of kidney qi. And so if I had this big pot of money, what I'd like to do would be to recruit a whole lot of people to start keeping very detailed records of extensive aspect, you know, like a full case history on these patients, to look at the clusters of different symptoms and signs that they have, to see if we're dealing with more than one thing here, or if we're dealing with, I'm aware that my reductionist brain is kicking in again. It's very annoying. Whenever we start thinking about this, the tendency is to home in on a particular thing and leave everything else out. And what I remind myself is that if we're going to be holistic about this, we need to keep all of the other things in mind as well. So the big challenge is to find a holistic way of doing research that will satisfy the powers that be that hold the purse strings for clinical practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of aims, aren't there? Are we talking about an efficacy trial that is purely looking to kind of establish a broad spectrum effectiveness of one treatment, in this case, acupuncture, over a control group? Great. In a broad sense, we can say acupuncture appears to be relatively effective for plantar heel pain. Go out and use it. If you've got plantar heel pain, go out and try acupuncture. But within that broad picture approach, you've got an endless amount of factors, and you've just been discussing a lot of these, of what kind of points for what type of heel pain for what type of person, however long they've had it, and combined with what else, presumably, and all other sorts. So it's interesting, even though we narrow down with acupuncture to, we're actually even just sort of picking a labeled condition here, there's still this endless web of complexity, really. When you're attempting to study something like this properly, rigorously, and in depth.
Well, we're narrowing it down to one condition, but we're also narrowing it down to one treatment. This label, acupuncture, also covers a multitude of sins. even defining acupuncture for the purposes of finding and selecting the papers that we were going to read was a challenge. Do we include just acupuncture, or do we include other aspects of traditional practice, such as moxibustion and all the others?
Yeah, absolutely.
We drew the line at herbs, but we did include, I've looked at papers on cupping and Tuinar and so on. But then looking in the other direction, there's this term dry needling. Do we include that as acupuncture? In the end, what we decided to do was we would include anything that included, that involved needling, that did not involve injecting something. And so that included acupuncture and dry needling and different techniques of acupuncture and so on. And we would include anything that used an acupuncture rationale, even if it didn't use needles. So micro tens, for example, or massage, if it was applied specifically. Oh, and there's one guy doing color therapy, colored lasers. But if they're applied specifically to acupuncture points and for an acupuncture-like rationale, then we included that as well. So that was the sort of broad net that we cast.
Yeah.
But I've noticed, I was in preparation for this, I was looking at the more recent publications, and they're all on dry needling. There's nothing been published about acupuncture that I've found in the last 3 years. There was one, and that's not quite true. There was one that was published on acupuncture, but it was using just semi-permanent needles to apply to acupuncture points. And then there were three other randomized control trials, and they're all of dry needling compared to either a control group or to PRP. So it's a concern to me.
Yes. And it's presumably a reason for that is that it's a relatively more simple or straightforward intervention to study, just the local dry needling approach.
Yes, I don't think that's the reason. The reason it's predominating at the moment is that there's a trend amongst physios, I think, in particular, around the world, to learn dry needling techniques. And then they are required to do research for their professional development. So this is the technique that they're using. And some of them will discuss it alongside discussing acupuncture. And there are some papers that seem to be very carefully excluding any mention of the word acupuncture or anything to do with it. So I see a trend in moving towards that dry needling discourse, shall we say,
yes,
in contrast to the acupuncture discourse that I see potential problems with.
Yeah. Understandably. I mean, I'll give an example of a patient I treated about a year ago now, a young lady with plantar heel pain, plantar fasciitis, whichever one you would like to pick. And this might be a relatively typical patient story, but it might also be completely unique. So it's a young lady, keen runner, very active, sporty type of girl, had gone from periods of intense running to periods of intense breaks from running due to other injuries and things like that. And the plantar heel pain was brought on by extensive periods of running. And then over the course of developing the heel pain, the other knee started to hurt and the lower back on the other side of the body. And you get these kind of compensation patterns. And I mean, you were talking about, Chinese medicine type syndromes earlier in the differentiation that can cause, but there's also these more complex musculoskeletal patterns that can evolve when one area of the body is in pain. You're going to avoid it, going to put more weight on the other leg, etc. So that would be, you know, a relatively common finding, but again, will present probably in slightly different ways and variations in different people. And then upon building upon that as well, there was a relatively high level of anxiety with this lady, and the running and the sport, you could see it wasn't particularly self-admitted by the patient themselves, a particularly healthy appetite or approach to exercise. She was overtraining. She was overtraining for various psychological reasons rather than just sort of performance or financial motive that an athlete would have. So then you open up a whole bigger perspective of what's going on for that patient, what's driving her to do that much training, and is it feasible for her to return to that level of training with a pain-free heel, or does a shift in habit, lifestyle, in quite a fundamental way need to occur for that patient to get the outcome of reducing the pain in their heel? So I mean, Spot, I'm sure you've had your experience with plantar heel pain and probably similar stories where on the onset they're coming for one very simple thing, but it's not a simple thing.
No, absolutely right. It's not a simple thing. And I'm just going to rattle off myself a few quick case studies just to show the diversity of success and diversity of treatment approaches. So case number one, my wife. So started getting lots of pain. I can't remember if it was both feet or one foot. And it so transpired that since she'd been working from home, instead of wearing shoes all the day, like you do when you go to the office, she was wearing these really cheap and nasty slippers with very thin, hard soles. And so I got her to buy some very nice, expensive slippers, and she got those and the pain went away. So that's case number one. No acupuncture, just looking after her feet a bit better. Case number two, definite nodule on the calcaneus that I could find. Whatever I did, no success. Okay. Treatment number three, found lots of trigger points in the calf muscles, needled them, pain went away quite quickly, a couple of treatments. And then another case, of which I've probably had a few of these, where I can't necessarily feel much of a nodule there on the calcaneus. And I've used electroacupuncture diagonally across the area, two channels on the machine, if you're familiar with electroacupuncture, of course. Again, a few treatments, decent success. Final case, the chap that came for had various conditions, and one of them was just on the list of the plantar heel pain. I treated him constitutionally, so I'm predominantly a five elements acupuncturist, so I used an AE drain as one of the first treatments we do. So I think it was a couple of treatments. His main condition that he came for was improved, and his plantar heel pain had gone. So, you know, stuck some needles in his back and his plantar heel pain went. So I've got, you know, five or six different ways of treating in various different levels of success. So possibly, Richard, it does come down to what you've said. There are maybe two, three or four different conditions that we call them all plantar heel pain, and maybe they should have, you know, some way of differentiating between them.
Indeed. But then the risk, of course, is that we reify these as new conditions, whereas in fact what we're dealing with is an infinitely variable population of patients. So, I mean, I think that's what led me to put forward the idea of refractive practice. I like playing with words. We're all familiar with reflective practice, mm-hmm. of course. But I found that what I was doing was looking at the issue through different lenses. I was using that metaphor. So I might use the lens of traditional acupuncture. I might use the lens of biomedical acupuncture, neurophysiological acupuncture, and the lens of psychology, you know, which might be motivational psychology or something else. Or I might use a social lens, looking at the person's hobbies or financial constraints from work and so on. And I realized that it's like I've got a whole set of different lenses, and I can't use them at the same time because that would just distort the image. I was reminded of a debate in the acupuncture discourse years ago about different paradigms being incommensurable. You know, you can't talk medical acupuncture and traditional acupuncture at the same time. And I've got some sympathy with that argument, although I don't think most practitioners care about it one way or the other. But I think if you've got both of these lenses, then you can use one after the other. So you might think in terms of qi and syndromes and B syndrome and so on, and see where that thinking takes you. But then you set that aside and you start thinking in terms of local innovation or segmental connections and so on, which might, of course, lead you to needle in the back for the for a pain in the foot if you're heading for the right segment. And so the idea of refractive practice is to have all these lenses available and apply them one after the other and see what each lens reveals that is meaningful to the case. And one of the lenses might be, I call it topological. Are we looking at something local to where the pain is, or something at a distance to where the pain is, or indeed something that's systemic, and so on. Is that making any sense?
Absolutely. So in terms of, I mean, one of the questions we were going to ask you and we'd like to ask you when you're coming on the show, Richard, because I'm sure we'll have a lot of practitioners eager with anticipation to hear your clinical gem, so to speak, you know, what particular techniques you found most useful for plantar heel pain, you know, on average, broad spectrum question. But actually, I think in a way, I think you may have already answered that by saying you've got to have a diverse toolkit. You've got to have these different lenses by which you can look at a patient's situation and ascertain the best way of going. And would that mean you would approach plantar heel pain in the clinic room from quite different ways, patient to patient, foot to foot?
Yes, indeed. And indeed, you might approach it in different ways depending on which clinic you're in. You know, whether it's an NHS clinic or a clinic that's funded by a well-to-do patient population. Yeah, so obviously the first thing one would do is take a thorough case history and include the broader aspects, not just which foot is it, where's the pain, right, let's stick a needle in it, which is what I've seen some people do. Take a proper history, look for patterns in the history, bear in mind the broader background, the patient's context, and also within the patient, the energetic context of the presenting complaint. And hopefully, any holistic practitioner worth their salt will be doing all that anyway. So given that the patient's specific focus is going to be the heel pain, assuming that that's what they've come in complaining about, then you want to look at the parameters of the heel. Is it better for cold? Is it better for heat? Does it have any other patterns of fluctuation that you want to take into account to influence what you're going to do? One of the gaps I've noticed in the literature is nobody talks about using moxibustion for heel pain. And yet, in many cases, it's very obviously a cold condition. So why not? Of course, if you're in an NHS context, that can be a problem, because using moxibustion in a room that's got oxygen piped into it is something of a no-no for insurance reasons, I guess. If you're deciding to use the local point, what are you going to do? Are you going to just needle it? Are you going to use the surround the dragon technique? Are you going to use one of these, what do they call them, mini scalpel needles that are written up in the literature that are rationalized in terms of breaking down the tissue adhesions? An explanation I'm not sure I accept. But Spod mentioned using electroacupuncture. That's another option that you might choose to use. And I'm afraid there's nothing in the evidence base that really tells us whether the one approach is better than the other. I think we just have to trust that in dialogue with our patient and in dialogue with the body of the patient, we can arrive at a best guess at what we should start with and then see how we get on. But recognize that we're going to probably do something different the next time. So another thing you'll see in the scientific literature is that there's almost a requirement that you do the same thing repeatedly.
Absolutely.
Treatment after treatment after treatment. But that's not real life, certainly not in my practice. Hopefully, when I treat somebody once, when they come back in a week's time, they'll be different. And therefore, what I need to do with them will be different. You may decide not to use the local point, of course. Patient might be apprehensive about it. So which distant points are you going to use? Well, the ones most commonly used are on the hand. But there's nothing in the literature that tells us which of the various points on the hand we should use rather than the others. Maybe we should use the tender one.
That trial that suggested P6 was potentially better than LI4.
Okay, good point. There is something in the literature that points us to one rather than another. That's true. However, there are a number of other points competing with that one.
Yes.
For attention, and they haven't been researched in that way yet. So I think it would be a mistake to exclude them. The criterion of tenderness is another of these things that interests me. If we go back to this very large pot of money that I could be given, I might focus it on the use of tender points in a number of different contexts, not just heel pain, versus the use of non-tender points. I wonder if that would make a difference.
Yeah,
I wonder what difference it would make. There are other local points, of course, which got used a lot in the research that we reviewed. Kidney 3, bladder 60, perhaps preeminent amongst them, and used in lots of different ways, different combinations with other points, with electroacupuncture, without electroacupuncture. I produced on my blog, on a website, I produced a very long list of all the different reasons that were given for using kidney 3. So you can see, even though that point is used very commonly, different people perceive it differently and use it for different reasons.
You could use it. It could be, as you said, this old theory of the bones involved was one reason for the kidney connection. But then, of course, it's probably the most common channel that's pathologically affected, isn't it? So it's a kind of local channel approach. You can also justify it. By the way, Richard's blog and website are excellent. There's a lot of great resources on there and summary on there and articles. It's linked in the episode description. So for a bit more of an in-depth look of what different points that were used in some of these trials and this research, that's please do go check it out. Richard, I think that's a really useful way to, you know, it's a very practical approach. Therefore, you're really describing in the clinic. Look at a broad lens, be flexible, be adaptive, patient-to-patient, session-to-session. I've just got a couple specific questions that I've been quite eager to ask you. Obviously, plantar heel pain is quite common. You're going to get calf tightness. This we know it's part of the most common symptom clusters. And just like the chicken and the egg, I'm curious whether the calf pain is a kind of a causative thing that appears first, then brings on the heel pain, or actually it's kind of symptomatic when the heel gets painful, the calf and some of the local musculature just kind of seizes up in protest. And there is a common approach, not just in acupuncture, where we might needle local points in the calf, trigger points in the calf, but physiotherapy, stretching the calf out, calf exercises. What mileage do you put in that kind of approach? And your thoughts.
Well, I guess we need to ask the chicken and the egg what they think about it. It's a very interesting one, and reflected in the most recent research as well. Clearly, somebody running on hard surfaces in bad shoes is likely to put strain and injure the foot. So, in some contexts, it may well be that injury to the plantar fascia is indeed the starting point. And in that context, then whatever's going on in the calf can be seen as secondary to it. But then they get into a vicious circle, and there's no point treating just the one. You need to treat both. And this is a shortcoming in a lot of the research. Some people only treat the plantar fascia. Some people only treat the trigger points. And I'll come back to that point in a minute in terms of how the research should progress. Clinically, another way of extending that thought is it's not just the calf. Tom Myers, the well-known practitioner of rolfing, put forward the idea of anatomy trains, and he talks about a particular construct which he calls a superficial back line. Which is a train of connective tissues that run continuously from the foot up the back of the leg, up the back, and across the head. And distortions or dysfunctions in one part of that tract can give rise to problems in others. In fact, Tom Myers himself has written about treating plantar fasciitis by working on the tract in the neck. And there are some papers recently, just one or two, that have addressed their research to this phenomenon. So they've tried treating plantar fascia by needling not just the local points, but the calf also, and then up into the thigh and the back. They don't usually go any further than that. My answer, I guess, is you need to look at both the heel and the calf, but also bear in mind that they're in the context of the rest of the body. And yeah. Tom Myers' concept is one way of extending that, but you might look at it instead in terms of the eight extra meridians or whatever other model you're familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. I also wanted to ask you about adverse event, particularly with local treatments, local needling of the foot, painful points, local strong massage. I know it's quite common physiotherapists to recommend a massage ball, a tennis ball, or something a bit more sinister to kind of roll the foot over. Were there any reports in the research you did of adverse events going deep local needling into that tender point, into the heel? Is that a potential concern for practitioners? And if so, maybe there's a subgroup or certain types, maybe more acute plantar heel pain. It might not be the wisest approach to start with. I don't know.
I think the simple answer is no. The obvious ones, some patients find it painful, particularly needling through the plantar surface. And some patients are too apprehensive to allow it in the first place, or wouldn't want their apprehensiveness to be overridden by some gung-ho practitioner. Some of the techniques are pretty invasive. Well, by our standards, they're invasive. I suppose by the standards of a surgeon, all of these things are very non-invasive. Microscalpel needling is, by our standards, pretty invasive and will lead to some bleeding and some tenderness. But it's expected, and forewarned is forearmed. And so if the practitioner takes that into account beforehand, then it won't be seen as an adverse effect. It will just be seen as part and parcel of the procedure. Similarly with trigger points, some people find needling into myofascial trigger points painful. Apart from that, I can't call to mind any adverse effects from those local treatments.
Right. So that should be quite reassuring to know, actually, that nothing's really been flagged so far with local needling and things like that.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, great. I'm starting to, if I could pinch a few wads of cash from that magic bag spot, I'm starting to just generally get an awareness of some helpful ways the research might be going forward. I mean, if you've got these dry needling trials coming out, just a broad spectrum comparison of, a very kind of Western medical dry needling type approach to treatment versus a broad picture, holistic acupuncture approach, which might very well use different points for different patients for different subtypes, syndrome differentiation, et cetera. On a broad level, it would be interesting to see if there are any differences in outcomes over the long term, differences in adverse events, for example, things like that. So I guess, in that sense, that could be useful. It definitely would be useful to see, as you were describing earlier, a kind of a more multi-arm trial where you're kind of going head to head with different approaches. I understand the limitations of that, for sure, but certainly a kind of a local plus holistic versus just local or just holistic would be quite interesting to see. I don't know if you've had any thoughts on those kind of things.
Well, you just give me a thought. One problem with this is that most acupuncturists don't deal with this problem very often because they're dealing with a whole range of things. And therefore, it's hard to build up any sort of body of work, any sort of momentum. Maybe a particular clinic, maybe a teaching clinic at one of the acupuncture schools might set up a project and get funding for it, a project where they specifically recruit people with this problem to come to their clinic, and the students could learn from that. And it would be an opportunity to collect a broader swathe of information about those cases.
Yes, that's a good idea. For the teachers of those student clinics, we know at least some of you are listening. So that's a good idea. Have a think about it. Richard, this has been really, really fascinating. That's been a really useful discussion for me as a practitioner. Very interesting as a researcher as well, but just as a practitioner, to just have a good hard think about not only plants to heal pain, but actually the implications of everything we discussed can be transferred to some extent onto treating lots of different types of pain and conditions, and having those multiple lenses. What was the term you used? Was it refraction? Refractive practice?
Refractive practice, yes.
Refractive practice, I like that. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me too.
Thank you, Richard. Bye for now.
For all the practitioners out there listening, as you're aware, AcuTrack is a podcast. It's also a clinical registry where you can monitor the outcomes in your own clinic. So if you're seeing patients with plantar heel pain, you're interested in tracking their outcomes, you're interested in submitting your case reports What we're trying to do with the AccuTrack Clinical Registry is compile all those results, compile all those case histories together into one clinical database where we can kind of get this big picture data in. As Richard mentioned, it's not the most common condition. We might not see a really high volume in our clinics, but of the hundreds and thousands of practitioners out there seeing people, there is the potential there to get quite a big body of useful real-world clinical data together. This is the sort of information that's absolutely essential for informing clinical trial designs, which points, syndromes, types and methods and approaches might be most useful to study. And we would be taking that data from the grassroots of clinical practice. So please do check out our website as well. That's accu-track.org. Please give us an email if you're interested in signing up and using the system in your clinic. It's a great tool, lots of good features on recording your Accu points and sending intakes on intake forms online and things like that as well.
Thank you very much for listening, everyone. We'll be back soon with some new episodes and exciting new guests. So please do subscribe to our podcast to stay in the loop. If you're an acupuncture practitioner and interested in starting on your own research journey, but not quite sure where to start, well, one of the best places to start is in your own clinic. Our goal is to make it as easy as possible for practitioners to actually engage in research and record their patient outcomes. So we've developed a new system to help you do just that. You can find out more by visiting our website at acu-track.org. Until next time, bye for now. I've been Spod.
I've been Nick.
And we've been AccuTrack.